and we're glad that you're listening. Our producers, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Henry Freinis at the controls this morning. In this hour, just to give you a little bit of tease, we'll be talking about one of the most interesting stories in U.S. automotive history. We'll be talking about a vehicle that initially generated enormous excitement. People were lining up to buy it, and then very shortly it turned out that it wasn't a very good car. Some people think it was one of the worst ever, and we come to the point where the car literally has become, very quickly became a joke. In this part of Focus, we'll be talking with Jason Buick. He is an assistant professor of history at Bridgewater College in Bridgewater, Virginia. He teaches modern European and world history, and he is a specialist in the history of the former Yugoslavia. And this morning, we'll be talking about the Yugo. When the Yugo was introduced in the summer of 1985, it was the fastest-selling first-year European import in U.S. history. 6 months later, it was a punchline. By 2000, listeners of NPR's Car Talk voted the Yugo to be the worst car of the millennium. In this hour, we'll look back on the car that became an international joke. And the story is told in a really interesting book that has just come out. The title of the book is The Yugo, The Rise and Fall of the Worst Car in History. And it is published by Hill & Wang. The book is out now by our guest, Jason Buick. And questions are welcome, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And, of course, you may email your thoughts, questions, comments to will-talk@illinois.edu. And Professor Buick, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Oh, absolutely.
And just to get into this topic, I know because I've seen you talk about it that your interest in, some people might say, well, you know, why would you even want to embark on this project? You sort of explained that, you know, being a Yugoslav American, you've always been interested in the handful of times when Americans were paying attention to anything that had to do with Yugoslavia, and this particular case, this would have been one of them.
Well, absolutely. You know, like any ethnic American, you always look for those moments in which your ethnic group enters American consciousness. And I was always interested in those few moments that Yugoslavia became something Americans were interested in. Many Americans remember Tito, the dictator. Some people have been to Dubrovnik on the Croatian coast, maybe the Sarajevo Olympics. But sadly, besides war, the number one thing that Yugoslavia was known for was this crazy automobile, and I wanted to know why that was.
Yeah, and I think also, I'm certain in every interview you've done, every time somebody talks to you about this, they say to you, now, was it really the worst car in history?
Well, you know, most Americans will say, I mean, you know, on Car Talk, it was voted overwhelmingly the worst car of the millennium. It's actually on the cover of a book called Crap Cars. And there's another one, it's called Automotive Atrocities. So most people say that, but Americans tend to see, you know, the United States as the world. They don't realize that many developing countries had cars. There were some truly atrocious cars in the Soviet Union and some truly atrocious cars in China. So the Yugo, the London Times actually said it was probably Eastern Europe's, communist Eastern Europe's best car ever. Which meant that there were many other cars that were far worse. On the American market, I would say the Subaru 360. It came out in 1968. It was a tiny, tiny car that was exempt from safety regulations. It had forward opening doors, so if you got or hit from behind or in a wreck, you could fly out of the car. The bumpers were lower than any bumpers of any car on the road. So even a simple fender bender could mean a catastrophic wreck. And it burned a quart of outboard motor oil every 250 miles. So Consumer Reports rated that, you know, not acceptable in 1968. There was a car called the Messerschmitt, which actually had two passengers in tandem. And you would start the car with a pull cord. So, you know, the Yugo was not at all the worst car in history and not at all the worst car sold in the United States, probably the worst car of the 80s, simply because it was a car built in the 1970s, sold 10 to 15 years later in the most competitive car market in the world.
Yeah, so that I know that for you, well, one of the interesting questions here is why, truly there were worse cars, so it's not the worst car ever, but why is it that it is remembered that way by so many people, most of whom never had any personal experience with the car. It's not like all these people who think it's the worst car ever actually had one or even knew somebody who did.
Yeah, well, I was shocked because the car was so famous. For me growing up, I'm a child of the 80s. I'm 37, and I remember parking in high school. I would drive my old used car, and I parked next to a girl with a Yugo, and people would tease this girl mercilessly. I remember they would pick the car up and turn it sideways in the parking lot as a joke. And we had plenty of, bomber cars that we drove, in our youth, and for whatever reason, the Yugo was the one that people fixated on. And I was surprised to see that though the Yugo sold 150,000 cars, which is a pretty good number, over that same seven-year period, Americans bought about 75 million cars. So I think you'd be hard-pressed to find an American who's really seen a Yugo. I'm sure you'll get a flood of calls from listeners, but if you went around asking, have you really seen a Yugo? Most people probably say no. It wasn't sold in all 50 states, which is really fascinating. And I thought it had a lot to do with the culture of the 1980s, the age of excess, the go-go years of Ronald Reagan. And you think of, cars as a symbol of status. That is the number one symbol of status in America. And during that period, Americans wanted to show their wealth. They wanted to, buy very expensive things and show those to people. And the Yugo was really at the bottom of the barrel in terms of status. And I think that's what really set it off and launched it into this meteoric, rise as the worst car in history.
Yeah. Well, you have to ask, though, that initially there was a lot of excitement about the car. There were people who literally were buying it sight unseen, or they were lining up to buy it or sign up to buy it just based on the advertising and having seen a picture of the car. And 150,000 of these cars were sold. Mm-hmm. One has to ask this question, why was there, before people actually realized that it wasn't a very good car, why was there so much excitement about the car, and why were there so many people who wanted one?
Well, one, I think, the price. It was $3,990, and Americans do love bargains. Cars are status symbols for most of us. Even if we drive an old car, for most of us, cars say who we are. But there's a small percentage of Americans, 1, 2, 3% that really will go for the blue light special. I think Car and Driver said that was the attack of the Kmart shoppers when the Yugo came out. It was a blue light special, and that some people just wanted the bargain. And that wore off pretty quickly. The other thing was the man who brought it over, Malcolm Bricklin, was just an amazing entrepreneur, amazing salesman. And he spent a good deal of money in the very beginning advertising the car. It was also a communist car sold in Reagan's America, which was shocking. So all of these things put together, Bricklin's salesmanship, people wanting a bargain, and then this whole communist thing really created what I call the consumer fad, which is dangerous in the automotive world. You really want to build clientele. You don't want to sell. You're not selling Beanie Babies. You're selling an automobile, and you want repeat customers. And I think they fell into the trap. They really thought they were going to go somewhere in that first six-month period, but they offered no new car for the next 7 years.
And I guess you do also, it was at a time when it was one of those times, and we do have them from time to time, that people in the United States start to become interested in the idea of small fuel-efficient cars. And so there weren't many of those cars being made, but certainly there was a niche for small, fuel-efficient, really inexpensive cars, and there really wasn't anything to fill that niche.
Yeah, well, what's amazing is some of your, any of your listeners over 35, 40, 45, you remember the small Japanese cars, the 60s and 70s. I mean, these were tiny, tiny cars, dangerous in a wreck, the high gas mileage, but fairly dirty little cars, not particularly well-built, but they got better and better and better. And by the 1980s, there were no more of these cars. Compare a Honda Civic from 1977 with a Honda Civic from 1987. Completely different cars. Mm-hmm. Japanese cars were beautiful by the mid-1980s. And this had to do with politics between the United States and Japan. Japan was really cleaning our clock in the low end of the market, and we threatened to put sanctions on. And Japan said, wait a minute. How about we put in a quota? We only sell about 2 million cars a year. And the Reagan administration said, great, that'll help our domestic industry and protect Detroit. But what the Japanese did very slyly was they went up market. If you're only going to sell 2 million cars, you may as well sell 2 million very nice cars. So by the mid-1980s, there really were no competitors at the very low end of the market. And so Yugo arrived at a moment when there was no one there, no one there selling a car under $5,000 when several years before there were many. Fiat had left, MG had left, Triumph had left. There's really no little cars at the bottom of the market to buy anymore. So Yugo hit the market right when there was a hole and a great deal of consumer demand.
Our guest in this part of Focus is Jason Vuick. He is professor, assistant professor of modern European history at Bridgewater College in Virginia, and he is the author of this new book, The Yugo, The Rise and Fall of the Worst Car in History. It is published by Hill and Wang. It's a history of the Yugo phenomenon, and among other things includes a bunch of Yugo jokes. So that's even an extra bonus here in the book. It really is a very interesting story, so you might want to take a look at it. Questions are welcome, and we got a couple of people here lining up and ready to go. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. We'll go to Oswego for the first here, line number four. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. I love this article, this book that you're talking about. I have to go out and get it. It sounds great. I laugh at the Yugo because I know somebody used to have one. The same guy owned a Pinto and a Corvair. So I can tell you what kind of guy he is. But, I wish today that the automotive industry would stand up and just take and change the way they make cars and change, you know, get something that's more fuel efficient. I know they're forcing the issue, the government is, but still, we're not there yet. You know, and I'm not talking about a Prius or anything like that right now because it's kind of like the beginning of something. But, you know, automotive industry, I wonder what – I always thought right now – today, what Henry Ford would be thinking, you know, and the foreign automakers. I mean, I can remember when I got my first Nissan. Back then, it was called Datsun. My first foreign car I had was a Datsun pickup in 1972. I love that truck. It ran like a top. It was easy to work on. It had no problem getting parts or anything. It didn't cost me a fortune. Now today, you compare that Nissan to a Ford Ranger. Good luck on work on it, you know, and then the second thing is it costs you a fortune to work on it when you do to get parts. And it's flip-flopped, and you wonder why, you know, the foreign automakers do what they do. They can figure out a way to make things cheaper and better. Now, as far as the Yugo, yeah, that was dirtier and crappier. But you know what? I really see this happening. I mean, I really see the American auto industry getting worse and not getting better just for the fact that other countries seem to do it in such a way where it's more affordable for the American consumer to buy. Why is that?
You have some thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I think a lot has to do with the culture of the countries where the cars come from. You know, for those of your listeners who have been to Europe or been to Japan, you know, coming out of World War II, Europe was destroyed. You know, you needed to build smaller cars. So there was the focus on smaller, more fuel-efficient cars. Same thing with Japan. And then Japan, once they came to the U.S. market, realized that there was a niche there, and they focused on quality and then just made their cars better and better and better. So a lot has to do with the culture of that. Americans like to, you know, be free, like to have, you know, big spreads of property. They like big cars, and I think that was one of our problems. You know, in the 90s, you know, Ford and General Motors went with the quick buck to sell these massive SUVs and really didn't focus on quality, which the Japanese have pretty much been doing all along, in spite of Toyota's recent problems.
It'll be interesting to see how this develops in the future, because there continue to be companies that appear to think that there is a market here for this kind of car, for a good car, that it's also small and fuel efficient. And for example, the Indian manufacturer Tata is planning next year in 2011 to introduce a little car, and we'll see how that goes. And I suppose that the Chinese are thinking, well, maybe we could sell some cars like that to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So it remains to be seen just whether someone can come along and actually provide a good vehicle to serve that need.
Mm-hmm. why the Nano is supposed to be coming soon. I know it's had some problems recently, but I want to see if Nano Mania, which will happen, will be similar to Yugo Mania. I think the Nano is a much better car than the Yugo was. It's got some Bosch designed parts, but still, you know, the seats are bolted to the floor. The door panels on the inside are glued on. It has one windshield wiper. I want to know if Americans can get over that need or that vision that cars mean status, that cars tell people who we are, because that's the main roadblock to the Nano, I think. It's not that it's fuel efficient, it's going to be wonderful, but will Americans truly embrace, you know, cars as mopeds?
Yeah, that's I think about the tremendous popularity of the Mini, the Cooper, and even though that is a very small car and people who have them seem to think they're the greatest thing ever. But I think what I've read about that is that also people want every single possible bell and whistle and every option and every. So they're buying this little car, but they're buying it loaded with everything you can possibly put into the car to make it as luxurious and as feature loaded as possible. So if you said you can have this little car, but it doesn't have a glove box.
Yeah.
Like the Yugo didn't have a glove box. People would say, "Well, no, I'm not gonna do that. I'm not gonna have one windshield wiper. I'm okay with a little car, but I want the best little car."
Well, if you think about it, the smart car is $18,000-$19,000. That's not very smart. I mean, I love those little cars, and I wish every American would drive one of those. A Prius is, you know, I don't know, into the high 20s, right? Into the low 30s. I mean, you know, that's a lot of money. And really, are you being, you know, environmentally conscious, fuel efficient? Yes, you are, but you're paying a lot of money as well, and that's going to be a problem. Until Americans really just want bare bones transportation like the Japanese cars used to be in the 70s, I wonder if they're really going to make it.
We'll talk some more about the Yugo here in a moment with our guest, Jason Buick. We also need to take a moment here away from the interview to urge people to support the station. We're doing a mini drive here yesterday, today, then next week we'll be back on our regular programming. But what we will be doing next week is counting down the days to the end of our fiscal year. That is Wednesday. And the reason that's important is that the programming that we do next year, starting on Thursday, will be paid for with money that we're raising right now. And through the year, we set goals. We say at certain points we'd like to have a certain amount of money in the bank. And right now, we're really coming down to the wire trying to raise the money for next year's programming. You can help us. If you have made a contribution, thank you. If not, if you've been thinking about it, why don't you take the opportunity to do it now? More and more people are going online to do it. And so you can go to our pledge site. That's willpledge.org. Or you can do it the traditional way. You can call us, 244-9455, and make the pledge that way. You can decide how much, but we hope that you will make the decision to be a supporter and help pay for the programming that you enjoy. Here in studio with me is Dave Teal. He's the program director for WILL-TV.
And good morning. It's great to be here, and certainly interesting topic this morning, as most of them are. I would say most of them are. Very interesting. So 217-244-9455 is the number to call. I got Dave Inch to smile about that. So, and but anyway, we hope that you do support this program. Dave puts an awful lot of work into this. As somebody who is occasionally filled in, every once in a while I get to fill in on this program, which is, I think, a great honor. I can realize how much work goes into actually researching a particular hour of programming. And so, you know, we hope that you support this effort. And you'll make that pledge call at 217-244-9455 or go online at willpledge.org. If you're already listening to us online, well, then it's very easy. You don't have to stop listening. Just open a new browser tab and go to Will Pledge. And it's... We try to make it very easy, and you know, it's very important that we hear from you at this time. We're really counting down to just the last few days of the fiscal year, and we've got a lot of ground to make up.
Yeah. And you're not just I hope that people will support the show, but of course, with their pledge, they're not just supporting the show. They're supporting all the other programs that they listen to, and I know that there are people who do listen on and off throughout the day. I'm sure they listen to Morning Edition, All Things Considered, The Afternoon Magazine. Maybe they listen to Fresh Air. They listen on the weekends, and they also listen to this show. So you're getting the whole package here. It's a full spectrum of a lot of different kinds of programs that you can get whenever you're ready for those shows. And even now, we have a lot of people who listen to us on the web, either in real time or at some time later, whenever they're ready, you can go back and you can listen to this show or a lot of other things that we do. So it's there for you when you need it. But right now, we need you.
Right. And, you know, we know, you know, we get a lot of calls during the week from people with questions for the guests. And, you know, I hope that the people who've called in and asked a question over the last month or even over the last year, you know, if you haven't made a contribution yet, we hope you'll do that right now. Because, I mean, you know, it's obviously we're a source of information. We think you value that source. And if you do, we hope that you will support it this morning with your pledge.
All right. Hope you will. Let me introduce again our guest, Jason Viewick. He is assistant professor of history at Bridgewater College in Bridgewater, Virginia. He teaches modern European and world history, and he is a specialist in the history of the former Yugoslavia. In fact, I understand he's just back from having spent time in Sarajevo. He's working on a book about the 84 Olympics, and he is the author of this book that we're talking about here this morning. The title is The Yugo, The Rise and Fall of the Worst Car in History. It's published by Hill and Wang. We have several callers here who've been waiting patiently, so we'll get to them and talk next with someone in Indiana. Line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I guess I'm calling for two reasons. One, I'm actually a person that sat in one and touched it. And it belonged to a buddy of mine who got rid of it pretty fast. But the thing I was thinking about, it would be nice for someone to do a book on small cars in the United States. The first thing that came to my mind was the Crosley, and there was another one called the Metropolitan that didn't last very long, but was an interesting shaped car. And, of course, you know, if you got hit with it, you were dead. There's no question about that. Crosley was a very interesting one. My grandfather was a car dealer. He sold Hudsons until they went out of business, I think, 53 or 54. And so he started selling oddball cars, and Crosley's was one of them, and I got to drive them. He used to call it a sewing machine motored operated vehicle, as I remember it. But it would be nice to see something like that about small cars that were brought into the country and how they were essentially mistreated by our culture in a lot of ways and not, you know, didn't actually use their possibilities and opportunities that they should be, and we may have gotten through this mess much earlier, but that's not what happened. But I just want to throw those two at you. I don't know if you ever heard of them or knew anything about them, but I could see you doing something like that later on, which would be a nice thing to buy.
Sure. Sure. I've heard of those cars. I don't know too much about them, you know, the early days. I was always floored looking at my standard catalog of imported cars, of all the different cars that have ever come into the United States post-World War II, at how many strange small cars there were. Small importers would bring over a few hundred to New York or Jersey, maybe the California coast, and there's been quite a few cars that you really wouldn't believe, you know, that were here. Škoda was here at one time, the Czech manufacturer. There was a Russian car. The Yugo was actually the third communist car brought over. There was a BMW Isetta, which was banned from the California freeway system because it was this tiny little car that was very dangerous to drive compared to all these big American cars. But you'd be amazed at how many small cars were brought in by people, and they just never really hit it with American consumers.
Okay. Well, let's go to another caller, Champaign County, line two. Hello.
Good morning. I'd like to nominate the Goliath, curiously enough, a very small car from Germany. I remember my father struggling with it in my youth. It was, I don't know if you've seen it, but it was, you know, all these were impossible to get parts for after a while. As you say, they brought over a handful of them. But ingenuity on the farm kept it running for quite a long time with improvised parts. But I did have a broader question, and I'm wondering whether Eagle Burger figures.
Oh, yes.
In this story, because, well, I always thought that it was so strange to have a secretary envoy to Europe called Eagle Burger to start with, so a lot of room for jokes there. But yeah. But he was, I think he was, at some point, was the major lobbyist for getting the Yugo in, mm-hmm. And then there was the contrary strain, as you say, having a communist car. Well, this was like, you know, a non-aligned car, and a Tito-mobile or something
yes.
That was. But at the same time, there's a strain on the left, and I'm not sure whether you grant any credence to it, which has to do, I think if you Google Illyrian experiment or Illyrian project for the the sort of the Greek name for the, mm-hmm. the Slav coast, you'll find some discourse about the idea that even worker-controlled, non-allied Tito economy was seen as a threat to U.S. Hegemony, and that it had to be extirpated, and many means were used in the global economy. And it seems to me that I think there might be a strain of well, some of the right wingers wanted to make money off of bringing in this vehicle from a nominally communist country, but others saw it as still part of the great supposed fight between the East and the West, et cetera, et cetera. That's a whole lot, and it takes a while to sort through all those strains, and I'm sure it's going to be a challenge for you to respond in a few minutes.
No, I think I can. And it took me a while in the book writing the book to figure out how to do that. But it all goes back to 1948. That's when Tito, the dictator of Yugoslavia, the communist partisan leader from World War II, he took Yugoslavia out of the Soviet orbit. It was never in the Soviet bloc. It wasn't a Warsaw Pact member. But at the very beginning, Tito was the most loyal of the Stalinists, but they had a very public dispute. Tito didn't trust Stalin, didn't trust the Soviet Union. So in 1948, Yugoslavia left the Soviet orbit, and that meant that the entire Adriatic coastline and thus the Mediterranean was no longer open to the Soviet Navy, which was a coup of immeasurable importance for the U.S. military. So we jumped in immediately, and Tito suddenly went from being a bad communist to being a good communist. And we jumped in with, you know, most favored nation status. There were Yugoslav students were Fulbrights. We exported manufacturing equipment, whole factories in the 70s. Dow Chemical set up a plant. Westinghouse built a nuclear power plant in Yugoslavia. That's amazing. Westinghouse building a nuclear power plant in a communist country. So we really didn't care about their internal politics as long as Tito kept the country out of the Soviet bloc. He borrowed enormous money through the 1970s. Yugoslavia was about $20 billion in debt, and they couldn't repay their loans. They couldn't even repay the interest on their loans at one point. And so we were jumping in, trying to figure out ways to support Yugoslavia. Now, the Yugo was never some sort of American government plan, but once the Yugo deal got going, our embassy, you know, we certainly were cheerleading, as one of the ambassador or one of the diplomats told me. Our ambassador drove around Belgrade in a yellow Yugo with American flags on the hood. This was, you know, common policy during that period. Lawrence Eagleburger actually came to the Yugo project. He was ambassador in Belgrade, and he was an undersecretary of state in the early 80s, left government service to work for Henry Kissinger with Kissinger Associates. So he was a private citizen, and he was hired for about $150,000 a year to lobby for Yugo America, the importer, and to serve on Yugo America's board. But from what I could tell from most people involved in the situation, he was simply paid to have his name involved in the project. He did very little, and the deal really had gone through by the time he was brought on. This gave him a lot of grief later when he was trying to be confirmed as Secretary of State or Deputy Secretary of State because he had been so close to this Yugo deal. But it is a fascinating history. You can also see the Sarajevo Olympics as kind of a last-ditch attempt by the Yugoslav government to develop the country, to bring in hard currency, to pay down this massive debt. And that was the Yugo project. They were hoping to sell cars, as harebrained as that sounded, in the American market to make hard currency to pay down the debt.
Okay. Again, I want to thank the caller. I have somebody else who's been waiting for quite a bit. I want to get to them in Urbana here, line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Came up to your mind. I think that my grandfather had an Isetta, something that was Italian made. It opened in the front. It basically was a motorcycle engine. The back wheels, a pair of back wheels turned to steer. He also had a Metropolitan. I can remember in the late 50s him visiting us and him trying to get out across the four-lane main road near my house and was scared to death that thing would never make it. But the as far as the Yugo goes, it's been sometime in the last 10 years on a Yugo? I would put a please steal me sign on it. But anyway.
Well, that's a rare Yugo sighting.
It's been in the last 5 or 6 years that happened to me that I saw that. But anyway. I thought that was quite an interesting follow-up on Yugos.
Excellent.
All right. Well, I thank you for the call. Well, we're talking about a rare now item here, and I think that one of the things that Jason, I know you had kind of looked into was how many Yugos are there that are still on the road now? And apparently there are only maybe a couple hundred?
Yeah, I estimated in my book 2,000, but then once this book came out and I've been doing interviews, and I was on a television program in New York, and they wanted to have a Yugo. They wanted to interview me. Actually, an NPR on Weekend Edition wanted me to drive around with Guy Raz in a Yugo in Washington, D.C. And I said, great, this is my big break. I'll do it. And they said, well, you need to find a Yugo. And then it took me it was a frantic search to find a Yugo. And the guy, we found a guy in Delaware to drive it down. And we really searched the eastern seaboard. So I would say there's a couple hundred left. At most, I know that one newspaper report from Florida said that in early 2000s or late 90s, there was one registered Yugo out of 17 million registered cars in the state, which is pretty amazing.
We have talked about the things that sort of came together to make this initially a fad until people actually got to see that it wasn't a very good car, that it got the benefit of a lot of good press, that maybe some people were excited about the idea that they could buy a new car that was less than $4,000. It was a little car, so some people were interested in small cars. It was a car from a communist country, so that for some people maybe that had an odd appeal to it. I find myself, though, going back to Malcolm Bricklin. Because, and I'd like to hear more about him. It seems that he had tried on a number of occasions to launch a small import in the U.S., and he's a guy who's been a car entrepreneur for a long time, has had some success, but has also had a lot of failure. He apparently just wouldn't let go of this idea, and he was walking down the street in London and saw a Yugo, and he genuinely thought this would be it. This would really work. This was a car that would make it, and he really thought that this would be a success.
Well, Malcolm Bricklin's a fascinating character, and I hope someday that someone will write a book on him or maybe even make a feature film. I think he's one of the great American characters of the 20th century. He's little known except in automotive circles. But he was just an entrepreneur. He's been in business school textbooks as a serial entrepreneur or an habitual entrepreneur. And what he does is he loves the chase more than producing a product, more than even selling a product. He loves starting businesses, gathering investors, pitching ideas, traveling the world to sign the deal. And he actually founded Subaru of America. He was the first person, along with Harvey Lamb, his partner, to bring Subarus to the United States. But he sold out very quickly before Subaru became Subaru. He tried to bring over a car called the Bricklin. It looked like an early version of the DeLorean. If you look it up on the Internet, it's a fascinating car in the 70s. He talked New Brunswick, Canada, into investing, by the end, about $25 million into the car. It failed miserably. Bricklin is an ideas man. He's not big on the follow-through. And so he then moved on to another idea. He tried to bring over some Fiat cars, Pininfarina and Bertone cars in the 80s. That was failing, and then he came on to bring over the Yugo. And Bricklin was one of those. I think the press just loves Bricklin because he's always there for a quote. He's always going to do something. They know that maybe he might hit a home run this time, but we're going to go watch because it could be a spectacular disaster. So he's always a good story. And I think that was part of the press. Bricklin is just an amazing wheeler dealer, truly amazing, and was able to drum up what Yugo America executive said in 1985 was about $20 million in free publicity before the car ever came out. Yeah. There was a great deal of excitement and anticipation for the Yugo in August 1985, and they called it Yugo Mania.
The Bricklin was really, I'm now here looking at a picture of it, the SV1, and it does actually bring to mind the DeLorean. It was quite I'm sure at the time it was pretty sexy. I don't know what kind of car it was.
Yeah, it was certainly very sexy, and he did the same thing. He drummed up, and he was in his 20s. and he was producing a car with his name on it. I mean, this is fascinating, using other people's money. I mean,
yeah.
The guy has chutzpah, and it's amazing what he was able to accomplish, both good and bad. I mean, he's made millions in his life, and he's been sued for millions in his life, but just a fascinating character. And the same thing with the Brooklyn car. It had gull-wing doors. And you look, the press, before anyone ever saw the car, dealers were putting down thousands of dollars for dealerships. Same thing with the Yugo. You know, and people were putting down – Canada decided to invest in the project sight unseen. They didn't even see the car.
Yeah. And what's also interesting, again, going back to his experience with the Yugo, while we think of the Yugo as being a famous failure, actually for him, it wasn't a failure.
Yeah, the company was tanking. It wasn't doing well, but it had a big name. I mean, the Yugo was one of the hot products of 1985, believe it or not. It was on national TV. They were spending, according to one estimate, about $800 a car on advertising, which is unheard of, huge money. It was on national news every night. And Bricklin, his CFO, his chief financial officer, went to find investors, and he found this is what I think was a crazy Wall Street investment firm that threw all of its money into the Yugo, and they bought Bricklin out. So just before the Yugo started to tank, he was bought out, and he walked away with, you know, from what I could tell from the records, about $5 or $6 million.
So for back over in Yugoslavia, the people who are working for Zastava, the people who are actually building the cars, what did they make of this boom and bust associated with Yugo in America?
I just have this vision. I've heard of this one meeting of Bricklin giving his sales pitch to a room of communist managers. And some of one of your callers mentioned self-management, that the workers ran the factory. But that was true to an extent. The factories were run, and the main appointments in the in the factory were communists. And so I can just picture Bricklin selling the Yugo idea. I will sell your cars in America. We're going to make this much money. We're going to do this. I couldn't imagine, you know, to be a fly in the wall. And they really had no idea what to make of them. And a lot of Yugoslavs were against it, but the factory really needed hard currency, and a lot of them got stars in their eyes and really bought into what Bricklin was saying. And he did deliver on the front end. On the front end, he did do what they thought was impossible. He sold the Yugo in the United States.
Well, and the car, as we've talked about it, they have several things going against them. You had a car here who essentially it was a Fiat. It was a Fiat design, but it was from 1970. So
yes.
So by the time that this car was coming to the United States in the mid 80s, it was already a 15-year-old car. They never introduced new models. It turns out it really was not a particularly well-made car, as we have discussed, probably not the worst ever, but not a very good car.
Yes.
So they had a number of strikes against them. At the same time, you wonder, well, would it at some point would it have been possible for them to turn things around and actually save the car in the U.S.?
Well, maybe, but that would have meant that Yugoslavia's economy would have needed to improve, and then Yugoslavia itself, you know, went through all these, you know, horrible political changes in the late 1980s, the rise of Milosevic, nationalist passions. You know, Yugo America went bankrupt before the war began, right before it began. But still, you know, for Yugo to have made it, I think they would have needed another foreign company, maybe Volkswagen or BM, someone to come in and help them produce cars to improve the quality. Bricklin didn't have the kind of money needed. He could sell the car with investors, but, you know, in order to change a factory, you need hundreds of millions of dollars, and that was way more money than a simple distributor had. And then Yugoslavia itself, you know, was – you know, about to die, and that was the main problem. The political system wasn't strong enough. The country was broke, and really no foreign car maker was going to go into a communist country in the 1980s to build automobiles.
Is Zastava still in business?
It was actually purchased by Fiat, and now it's called Fiat Automobiles Serbia, Fiat Automobili Serbia, and I'm hoping it's going to make it. They're going to make Fiat Puntos and other little cars, but right now I've heard that Europe has a great deal of overproduction, of surplus production. So, you know, I don't think they're making a lot of cars at this moment, but I was just over there, and I heard that they were giving you, you know, trade-in value, 1,000, 2,000 euros for old Yugos and old Zastavas in order to give you new Fiat Puntos. So there's a trade your Yugo in deal.
Yeah, it sounds like you couldn't possibly go wrong on a deal like that.
Yes, I'm going to miss them though. I was walking through Sarajevo the other day last week, and I just counted 10 Yugos on the street, and I thought, never again.
So there are still Yugos there. The people are keeping them. Yes. They're still running, and they're still driving those cars.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you come from a country where, you know, people make about $500, $600 a month, you know, you can buy a car for $800, $900 equivalent. I mean, you will keep it running. You need a simple car, and it is transportation. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. Also, I'm sure it provides work for a lot of mechanics.
I think everyone fixes their own cars over there.
You had the opportunity to talk with, I think, some of the people who were involved in trying to sell and market Yugos here in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And that it seems that some of those people actually thought maybe they got kind of a raw deal, or at least that the car actually wasn't quite as bad as people said that it was.
Oh, yeah. You know, and I did feel bad when I was coming out, you know, with the book, the title, you know, The Rise and Fall of the Worst Car in History. A lot of people put their heart and soul into this, and a lot of very talented people went over with Bricklin or were hired by Bricklin to get the car ready. They prepped what was essentially a dated, communist-made, you know, 70s automobile. They prepped it in about 9 months and passed U.S. safety tests and U.S. emissions tests. So no matter how the car is remembered, in terms of engineering, in terms of, you know, what needed to be done simply to bring a car over, these guys did what, you know, one person described as a Herculean feat. And it really was. And I found them all, you know, very devoted and very intelligent car guys who were very proud of working there. They had a lot of freedom. You know, you think of someone at Ford or GM, you know, couldn't make the decisions, you know, like they did. They were able to make decisions, you know, in 2 weeks they could fix whole parts in the car and order the parts and get the parts ready to go. Imagine how long that would take at Ford or GM, those kind of, you know, committee decisions. So they really remember their time there as a positive time. They really wish they could go back and do it. And I've spoken with people who are execs at BMW and Volvo and other places who had very positive experiences during their early years with Yugo.
So there, at the eve of the Yugo coming to the United States, those guys in the process of getting the car ready so that they could bring it here actually improved the car. It sounds like it was actually a better at that point. It was a better car than it had been before.
Oh yeah, and within Yugoslavia at the time, you could if you knew someone, you could get the American Yugo, which was better. It had better interior, better lights, better paint. Just better quality. And for how poor the quality was by American standards, they really did improve it. I mean, the paint came in from PPG. They got, you know, better assembly line, you know, products, better, you know, carburetors, you know, various things were added to the car to make it workable. And there's a lot of people who like those old Fiats and like those old Yugos in the United States, even today, that, you know, like those little cars.
Yeah.
You know, remember International Motors. Remember in the 70s and the early 80s, you could go get your car fixed at these places that specialize just in international cars. We don't really see that anymore.
They must have, those guys, though, when they saw that factory, they must have just been horrified.
Yeah. The first time they went over there, it was a armaments factory from the 1850s. That had survived. Zastava actually made weaponry, not cars. And then after World War II, they began building cars and got a license from Fiat. And it was this old, dingy factory, filthy floors, with just very little focus on consumer quality, product quality, quality management, simply because it was a communist country. You sold one car, you stood in line for it, or you ordered it and it came 6 weeks, 6 months later. You had no say over the car's color or interior. So this never trickled down to the workers. Why make a better car? There's no demand for it. And so the Americans had to change the mentality there, and to their credit, they did, which was pretty amazing.
Yeah. So coming down to the point where, in a way that we started again, to talk about why it is that, you know, of all the bad cars people could talk about and all of the attempts people to bring small, eccentric European cars in the United States, why it is that the one that's the big joke, you can always get a laugh. All you got to do is say Yugo. And people are going to start laughing. And you have been good enough to provide with the book a number of jokes. jokes like, let's see, what do you call a Yugo with a flat tire? Totaled. Or how do you get a Yugo to go 60 miles an hour? You push it over a cliff. How do you make a Yugo go from 0 to 60 in less than 15 seconds? The answer is push it off a cliff. So, you know, why is it of all these other things that Yugo is the one that became the joke?
Well, I mean, I guess, and it's hard to put your finger on, but again, I go back to the culture of the 1980s. You think of the movie Wall Street, or you think of Risky Business with Tom Cruise. I mean, you know, everyone aspired to show their wealth, not just to keep up with the Joneses, but I wrote, it's an era of if you got it, flaunt it. Bottled water, think of clothes, Calvin Klein, Ralph Lauren, Jordache, members only. You know, these were, during the Reagan years, there were 4 and 5 years in a row in which Jaguar, BMW, Mercedes had record years, record sales. And I think it was just an era when, no teenager would be caught dead in a car that screamed low status. And I think, that was the era in which, other products took off, sports, sports marketing, Michael Jordan, Nike, Adidas, all that stuff. And it all came out of the 70s, but really hit its stride in the 80s. And I think the Yugo was just perceived as the poorest consumer product, but it was one that had been pitched so widely. And when it was panned in 1986 and early 1986 by Consumer Reports, which was the car-buying Bible, it still is for most Americans, that it became national news. It became a national joke. And so cars are such powerful status symbols that I think once the Yugo became a national joke in that generation, it was hard to shake it. And I really think you can't find a car that people make fun of more in our history, more than Pinto, more than, the Gremlin or the Pacer, and certainly not anymore. People just don't make fun of cars the same way they made fun of the Yugo. I mean, it's overwhelmingly the worst car of all time to Americans. I don't really think it is, but that's really, what we're talking about, the Yugo mythology and the Yugo story.
It's a great story, and you can read about it in the book, The Yugo, The Rise and Fall of the Worst Car in History, by our guest, Jason Buick. He is assistant professor of modern European history at Bridgewater College in Virginia, where he teaches modern European history. He is a specialist on the history of the former Yugoslavia. If you go looking for the book, his last name is spelled V-U-I-C. And thank you very much for talking with us today. We appreciate it.
I enjoyed it very much. Thank you.